The theme for the evening talk is the nature of grasping. Just before flying here to Israel, I was at Heathrow Airport in London, which I know better than my own home, and just before boarding the plane, I noticed in the magazine shop there the current issue of Newsweek, this American news magazine that most of you would be will know about and will probably absolutely refuse to buy if you have any sense. But myself not having enough, I saw this on the cover, and as these things are intended to do, pull in the customer's attention, and so I bought the damn thing, and it's called "Is God Dead?" question mark. And then in typical Americanism, in Western Europe, it sure can look that way. And then there is the tomb of God with the cross above it. So I picked it up, and after wading through the love life of Rupert Murdoch, other major cosmic events, I finally came to the feature called, entitled, as you can see, "Lost in Silent Prayer." And so then I had the misfortune to carry on reading it. It's rather grim news for God, I would say. He certainly seems to have been forgotten. It says that in West Germany, in 1991, 14% of the population went to church regularly. And that figure is now cut in half to 7%. A grand total of, in Norway, of 4.6% went in 1991, and that's now down to 4.1%. Only 3 to 4% of people in Paris go to church. In Britain, 89% didn't attend church regularly in 1995, and of the established church, that's the Anglican Church in Britain, 99% of the population didn't go to church. And the Archbishop of the Anglican Church, of which there are some, I think, 300 or 400 million Anglicans around the world because of the old colonization, said that, if I can find it here, that the church is, quote-unquote, one generation away from extinction. So the article points out, and then it says, I don't know if you know the word wacky. Does people familiar with wacky? Can it be translated into Hebrew, wacky? Really? Off the wall, strange, odd, peculiar, bizarre. Christianity has become an alternative lifestyle as wacky as atheism once seemed. So that, and it reminds me when I was in a restaurant in London, and I went to the toilet, and someone had written behind the graffiti behind the door in the toilet, "God hasn't forgotten the world, but right now he's working on less ambitious projects." Yeah. And I thought it was rather a wonderful and deep insight. Anyway. So sometimes beliefs which seem strong and true and absolute, as it were, in one generation, and very much taken for granted, that in the inner changes through education, secular culture, etc., that which was grasped onto and identified with and made to be the truth of the day, generation or two, it's only a generation, two or three generations in terms of Europe, seems to have less and less relevance. And so it becomes increasingly more difficult to accept some of the core beliefs, in this case of Christianity, the most famous and extraordinary one. One has to be the physical resurrection of Jesus into heaven. And when I heard on a religious affairs program in Britain, one bishop or archbishop say, "I wish there were cameras 2,000 years ago in Palestine to be able to photograph the physical erection." No, that's a Freudian slip. Next I'll say insurrection. That might be closer. Resurrection. There. That from an educated person to actually believe that, I just look for my remote and so I can't take this. Or the Virgin Mary and many other. The outcome of all of this, of course, it generates an increasing degree of disillusionment, and thus it's gone from the grasping onto the identification with, to an increasing level and degree of doubt and dissatisfaction with. And the teachings, the Buddha has spoken a tremendous amount, of course, about grasping. And just recently, the Methodist Church, which you might think, if you don't know Christianity, it means they have method. They don't. It's just called the Methodist Church. Yeah, actually had a debate, in a national debate of the Methodist Church in Britain, whether or not people should be allowed to join the church who don't believe in God. And I thought, it's beyond my comprehension. So be grateful you're in Israel. Yeah. So, in the teachings, there is that which is present. The point I'm trying to make here: that which is presented to us, and in that which is presented to us, sometimes we look at ourselves and we say, "I can't buy this. I can't accept this. I just don't believe this," or whatever it might be. In all religions, and Buddhism is no different, has these extraordinary kind of beliefs which seem out of touch with how we see, perceive and experience the world. And the teachings remind us very well, and I think very importantly, like no teachings on earth in some respect, the tremendous importance of living a life and the way of life of non-grasping. And to understand deeply and clearly what non-attachment or non-clinging or non-grasping is. And one of those, of course, does, and there are four specific ones, does involve rites and rituals and beliefs in which, in the grasping of, not the act of here, but in the grasping of and the strength and intensification of identification with, there's a certain exclusivity that can go with it, a feeling, and this is, the emotion gets involved, a feeling of exclusivity with it, and in the feeling of exclusivity, it creates a world of being in or out of. Doesn't only apply to Christian groups and sects, as we know only too well. So something goes on. It doesn't seem to be per se the problem of the ritual, the problem of the service, nor even the problem of the belief as such, but something easily goes on in the movement of the mind, which holds to, clings to, fixes, identifies around, and then there's this strange phenomena in human existence of one is either in or out of. And those who are in regard themselves in some way or other as special, and this is, goes on all over this world in countless circumstances. And once there is a specialness in one area, there's a non-specialness in another area. When that intensifies, of course, it's the breeding ground for conflict and all the other terrible consequences. And religion, unfortunately, has played a part in that, as much as ideology, beliefs, secular beliefs, etc. And sometimes there is a fear which generates the grasping, in which in the relationship to whatever that perception may be, the fear is, if I don't grasp onto, if I don't hold onto this, if I don't cling onto this, it will decline, it will crash, it will dissolve, and it will be lost. So then the feelings, the emotions, and the mind come in with a very strong view that clinging and holding onto will preserve. It's not true. And what tends to happen is that in the very course of time, the pressure to hold and cling to brings fragmentation. It begins to crash from within. And this is going on all over the world in various ways. And clinging and grasping and fear and intolerance and holding and wrapping around is actually destroys things from the middle. And therefore, there's an inability to adjust. The church is grasping and clinging onto these beliefs which most intelligent human beings just cannot swallow. It's actually the destruction of it. So something in the movement, as I say, it's not the events themselves, not really the beliefs themselves as such, but something else goes on with this holding, which is destructive, both for within and for without. And so sometimes we can't imagine religious life without it. We can't imagine cultural life without the grasping, or national life without grasping. We can't perceive of another way of relating to things which shows a wisdom rather than fear and grasping. But Dharma teachings and practices are a constant encouragement to re-evaluate and therefore to look at in life, what are we grasping on to and what are the consequences? And can we view in completely fresh ways so that we're not isolating a specialness, one or two singular beliefs, and I think Christianity has to take a lot of responsibility for this, the proselytizing all over this world, the destruction of other cultures as a result of it, etc., etc. Through some core idea which attempts to get others to submit to. It only happens through grasping, only happens through clinging. The very convent where we were was where we are now, that it expanded in the 1950s, 60s, and through into the 70s, it was absolutely full. They were building extensions on the convent. They built a huge chapel on the convent. The missionaries were coming back from all over the world. The place was completely full. In the space of 10 to 15 years, it went completely full to five nuns in 54 bedrooms.
It crashed from within.
So sometimes we have to look at, as I say, we look to ourselves. In this case, I'm referring more specifically to religious beliefs, rites, rituals, ceremonies, etc. Looking at our relationship to it and see what mode the grasping may take. And that sometimes happens, as some of you know, with methods and techniques here. It's not like it's just confined to a feature in Newsweek magazine. And sometimes in meditation work and in the inner work, it isn't easy, and there's a certain kind of vulnerability in a way which goes with it. And what I've got in mind in the kind that goes with it is where a person is practicing, and then he or she is told, as a number of you have heard in different places, only do this method. Anybody who hears the word only, it should send up immediate alarm signals. It should give one some feeling in the longer term view of things of concern. And what tends to happen is we get benefit from something, whatever that may be, of course including here as well as elsewhere. Then we are given some other message which goes along with it, and we are encouraged or persuaded or told or whatever that this is the only way, or if they're a little bit softer, the quickest way, or the way which is most true to the tradition, or that which has been preserved for a very long time, or the one which has had the most success with the most people, or because it says so in this particular book, or whatever. And it all becomes ways and means, as human beings, that we are basically encouraged to grasp onto that, to stick with it, to do nothing else, because if we do nothing else, we're only wandering around in the spiritual supermarket, and then we'll get lost. It's an interesting idea. But it's rather tragic when it comes out of the Buddhist tradition, which one is getting the message, grasp onto this method, grasp onto this technique, grasp onto this form, and the teachings are saying nothing is worth grasping onto. And that is happening. And it's not easy to have, as I mentioned previously, a different kind of relationship, and the two features of a different kind of relationship are, one is ruthlessly, sincerely and deeply committed to non-grasping, non-clinging, non-holding on to, and one knows the value of connection. If a person just hears the message of non-grasping, whatever it might be, one could end up, any form we involve ourselves, anything that we engage in will just produce grasping. But if we look carefully and we can know the difference between connectedness and the importance of that which is different from grasping. And one of the ways that there is grasping going on is the tendency to want to keep boosting up one thing and having to slag off and put down anything else. And this creates this kind of world of exclusivity. And one of the ways that we can show that and see it in ourselves, let's say we're having a difficulty. One person mentioned difficulty today with a tradition, not unusual. And it's not reference to that person, but we're having a difficulty with something, and it's raising questions or it's raising some doubt. And then we find ourselves in a situation where we can only find fault. We can only see what's wrong, and we can't see anything at all that we can appreciate. And everything we say in the moment, when we actually believe very strongly. When the mind is moving in that way of just finding fault, just blaming, just putting down, just criticizing, and we're very much involved in it, it's telling us it is grasping. So sometimes the grasping that goes on, the holding that goes on, is wanting to be with, the attraction towards, the identification with. And sometimes the grasping that goes on with us is quite the opposite. It's in aversion. It's in reaction. It's in negativity. And we're still holding on. And if there is some balance of view, and if there is some non-grasping, even with things that you and I may not appreciate, and we may feel concern about, whatever, nevertheless, we can find the appreciation for that, even with the criticism. I may criticize the church, but I'm the co-founder of a school for the poorest children in Bodh Gaya, with 360 children from illiterate families and children from the streets. And the head of my school is a Catholic nun, and she and the other nuns and lay people and the Hindus, Muslims and Buddhists are doing absolutely wonderful job with our school. Wonderful job. So I may say, well, I don't believe this and I don't believe that, but certainly if there's non-grasping, it isn't reactive, and we can see what there is to appreciate, and we can see what this credible message of the rabbi from Nazareth, of his incredible love, fearless love, speaking his heart no matter what the consequences are. And I think it's a tremendously wonderful statement for this earth, and it has inspired men and women in that area. But it doesn't often have much to do with the church. So sometimes when we look, we can see what is to be appreciated and see what the concerns are. And if you and I putting down somebody, slagging somebody off or whatever, it's important just to be aware in that, hey, is this grasping? And therefore there's no space inside to look at what we might appreciate. But it's important for our own clarity here. Other forms of grasping which take place, and this isn't, the common one in secular culture, which has its own silly beliefs as well. They're just as silly, I mean. And that kind of idea, by securing, this is Buddha's teachings on the grasping and attachment, what he calls after sensual pleasures. Virtually every advertisement is an encouragement for a sensual pleasure. It'd be hard not to... I'd be very hard to think of one which isn't, really. So there's this constant bombardment, and there is a promise that if we get these things, we all know this only too well, if we get these things, it will make us happy. It is a complete lie. It's a complete self-deception. And when I saw an advertisement, I think it was for a Peugeot car in Britain on the television, and the guy is driving around with this face of kind of supreme confidence. And then he gets out of his brand new Peugeot, and he turns around and looks at it, And then he said, and then the advertisement comes on at the bottom. It says, "When you own a Peugeot, you know who you are." I went, "Oh!" I mean, what's the difference between that and poor old Jesus going Apollo-like rocket up? They are both out to lunch. And we get this messages from all sorts of ways. And somehow, I think sometimes the only way of resolving these things is humour. If we lose our sense of humour, we'll start taking the advertisements and the odd messages of us all far too seriously. So sometimes there is this movement through the senses, and one of the difficulties is, and in one of the small groups, I think yesterday we touched upon this, is the difficulty of the word desire, insight or wanting. And in Buddhist language, as most of you will be aware, the wanting or desire, the language, the words you and I use frequently, we use interchangeably. Oh, I know, I'm hungry, I want to go and have something to eat, I want to go to the toilet, or I want to go to the shops to buy something or whatever. And certainly where there's a movement of wanting, it's worth attention to, it's worth our being aware and mindful of. And then sometimes a person says, but surely I want to be enlightened, I want to meditate, etc. And doesn't the Buddha say that any kind of desire produces suffering? Therefore, whether I want lunch or I want enlightenment, it's still a wanting, and etc. So language which you and I use might be quite interchangeable, but not in the teachings of the Buddha, in the language. Meaning, when we are here exploring here, what the encouragement is to develop right intention, to develop interest, to cultivate, to develop, to apply resolution towards, to bring in right effort. And all of that application, as we've been doing over the days, contributes in life, hopefully, to greater clarity, opening of the heart, and deeper understanding. Sometimes it's quite neutral. I want to do this, I want to do that, etc. But sometimes we know we have grasped onto what we want. We have grasped onto what we want. It may show, that grasping may show itself in an expectation. That grasping may show it in the feeling and the thought, if I don't get what I want, I'll have no peace of mind. It may show itself in a single-mindedness towards something in the belief it will bring satisfaction, a career, making a lot of money, having children, or whatever it might be. So sometimes we feel the movement inside of us, and we see that there is a wanting which is taking place. And when the grasping and clinging and identification with the wanting gets stronger, it creates a pressure for us, and we become increasingly more dependent for our inner peace on getting what we want. And this becomes the recipe for a lot of anguish, a lot of frustration, a lot of disappointment, countless feelings of failure, and then one then kind of falls back on the idea in some way or other that my wanting I can't live without wanting, so that's what happens. I want, and therefore I suffer. I want, I get, and I get some pleasure. The awareness, which we've spoken about many times over the days together, the mindfulness will contribute, hopefully, to our being a little bit more conscious, a little bit more vigilant, and catching the force of the wanting. And seeing what that is about. And maybe the same action can be converted from wanting to interaction, to connection with, to support for. But enough awareness to see how much the self, the I and my, is caught up in the wanting. And sometimes when we are caught up in it, not only do we make our life very, very difficult for ourselves, but make our life very, very difficult for other people. And what makes life difficult for people is the strength of the wanting. You think about it. What makes life difficult for human beings is the strength of the wanting. And because we live in a secular culture, religious culture, apparently in Britain, only for one more generation, that because of the strength of the wanting that goes, and all the messages, it does seem genuinely hard to see a way of life which isn't in it. But there is a way of life without it. And it's active, and it's engaged, and it isn't one of being alienated from nor detached. And so something goes on inside the human being who begins to feel, this is the important thing here, begins to feel a difference in engaging and making decisions, engaging with and the ability to respond. And knowing the difference between that and being trapped in wanting, dependency, and one's well-being relying on the result. There's an actual feeling inside of us between one and the other. And that feeling, that sense, that knowing or intuition makes all the difference. One is liberating, and the other, the wanting, the desiring, and the clinging, and the holding, and the grasping, is imprisoning. And if you and I can just get enough power of attention in our life, in our daily life, we'll actually feel when this unsatisfactory wanting desire is moving inside of us. And something, the wisdom and the interest and the exploration in it will come in very, very quickly. Like as one person said during the retreat, she was engaged in the meditation, and then she noticed that the thought was going along a road and going in a certain direction, and if one went in that direction and kept going, it would just lead to problems, to feeling depressed, to feeling conflict, confused. One just knew it. The seeing of it early stopped what? It stopped the wanting to go along that road. That's all. And that stopping wanting to go along that road saved her, the inner life, from going into a very painful situation. Just with the mind. That's what we mean when wisdom and intuition and awareness cuts the power of the wanting. And if we just left here tomorrow and never did any more method and technique, never set foot for the rest of our life in an environment like this, And we just went away with one interest, to look at the force of wanting, the force of desire, in all those unsatisfactory modes. It would be a wonderful service for the whole species. On the night of the Buddha's awakening, which actually he never spoke about very much, well, there's just two or three clear examples, illustrations there. And in the latter period of his life, in his more nostalgic moments, he was asked about what happened under the tree. And so Sariputra, his close friend, asked him. And then he gave general details of what happened through the night. And then he said he realized human beings are concerned with four major truths: suffering, cause, often bound up with wanting and desire, ending the suffering, and how to end it. And sometimes when we look at ourselves and our daily life, in various ways we are trying to do that. Unfortunately, there isn't always the skillful means. And of all the factors which can cause suffering in life, many, the one that he highlighted and picked out was this force of wanting and desiring and grasping. Sometimes it's so obvious to us, but it's hard to shift away from, it's hard to let go of, it's hard to see into. So there's rituals, ceremonies, beliefs, etc., one form, the pursuit of pleasure as a kind of lifestyle, that's the secular priorities and values, the movement and the force of wanting that goes on in our life. And another common one, and probably most meditators witness this in themselves, and it's not so much, say, around secular, you know, pleasure, one form. It's not so much about rituals or religious and all the views that go along with it. But a very strong one that goes on with us is the desire and the grasping onto becoming. The grasping onto becoming. And these ideas which circulate within us of what I would like to become. And then we add some nice sweet little word on the end of it. The imagination gets flowing with regard to it. And we think and imagine, when I become this, it's just going to be wonderful. When I've finished this and I've become something else, and this movement inside of grasping onto what one will become in the future is an incredibly powerful one. And we can't imagine living our life without constantly having to think about what I will become in the future. Sometimes it's fueled with desire and attraction, but sometimes the desire force and the grasping is fueled with fear and worry. Both feed the inner movement towards grasping, either attraction on the one side or aversion or fear on the other. And we identify strongly with this movement that's going on inside, and we believe in it. And we sometimes we can't imagine a way of being in this world in which the future is nothing else but either attraction or aversion. How great it will be or how bad it will be. And the grasping and the identification with it stops us from saying, where is this springing from? Where is it coming from? How have I got myself to actually adopt and identify with such a position? I remember from the old texts, the Buddha, a man named Bahiya, came to see him, and had travelled up from Maharashtra, which is a state in western India, and had walked through to the Buddha Gaya region. And he was wanting to know some answers to one of the issues of life. And then the Buddha kept putting him off. He said Buddha was doing his begging round for food, etc., etc. And said he would meet with him afterwards. And the Buddha just said to him some three or four simple sentences. And they registered so well and so clearly that Bahiya understood exactly the significance of it. And the Buddha said, oh, thanks very much. In the seeing, there is just the seeing. In the hearing, there is just the hearing. And in the knowing, there is just the knowing. It's been a text which monks and nuns have contemplated on and meditated on for the last 2,500 years. It's well spoken of in the monasteries. In the seeing there is just the seeing, in the hearing there is just the hearing, and in the knowing there is just the knowing. What if we took that very deeply, not just as some kind of sweet aphorism, but we actually contemplated that really deeply? What would it do to our views about what I will become in the future? If one says, today, in the seeing there's just the seeing, in the hearing there's just the hearing, and in the knowing there's just the knowing. Therefore, tomorrow, there will just be, in the seeing there's just the seeing, just the hearing, and in the knowing there's just the knowing. That something will be grounded and well established with us in the essential features of existence, which would bring to us a balance and a clarity, which will eliminate all the projections and fears about tomorrow, and even more importantly of this, it brings its own joy. So finally, in terms of Dharma teachings, there is the movement of the wanting and the grasping that goes from the inner to the outer. Human being looking at all of this sees, where in my life does this go? Where does the strongest form of wanting go? What are some of the consequences and effects of this on myself, or on my family, or my life, or the life of others? Can I transform it in fresh ways? And more important, or as important as all of that, is what would it be, even for a moment, to sense in the deepest truth of things, nothing whatsoever is actually graspable? What would it be just to be, and to know and sense that actually nothing can really be grasped onto? that the very movement and unfoldment of life doesn't allow that continuity of grasping. That things shake our life inwardly and outwardly, and constantly exposing us to the problem and the difficulty and the anguish associated with any kind of grasping. You think about it. Anything. About ideas, about rituals, about beliefs, about personal desires and aims, about what I will become or whatever. Think of all the things in life that one has grasped onto, suffered over, and now have no part to play in your life, no relevance in your life. And we have said to ourselves, my goodness, I can remember, and that could be earlier today, or it could be years ago, when I grasped onto a situation and it caused me incredible problems. And the whole unfoldment of life has gone on. What good did any of that grasping do me? What difference did it really make? Except to make my life difficult. And so things which were a huge drama in our life, built up through grasping and clinging and holding and attachment and wanting and possessiveness and identified with, and it's come and it's gone. You think, what on earth was all that about? And we can't remember the moment when we stopped grasping it. It was a great drama. It stopped being a great drama. Life has moved on. And we can only remember that it was a great drama. And what the hell would I want to cling to something which was dissolving anyway? So even the graspable, in the deepest truth of things, is actually ungraspable. About anything. And so the Buddha keeps pointing wisely and insightfully to this, and therefore has spoken of liberation as the ungraspable. I can't even get hold of that and keep it. And I can't get hold of my life and keep it, and I can't get hold of anything around me and keep it. The extraordinary diversity of all this reveals actually we can't grasp onto anything. We can't hold it. In the moment we think we can. We believe we can. Funny old world. And this story, which they always use in the East, and you will have heard it before, finally is, and some those of you who lived in forest will know this one fairly well. When I was a monk living in the forest village in Buddhadasa, we didn't use a torch. We had a cocoa tin, and then we cut a hole in front of the cocoa tin and put a candle in it, and the reflection from the cocoa tin light just gave a few feet in front. So we'd hold the cocoa tin in one hand in the night, had the stick in the other, walk through the pathways of the forest so that we could see enough, and the banging of the stick moved the insects or the creatures and the snakes out of the way. But sometimes some things, and there was one snake which never moved out of the way. It always sits on the coil. So one was always a little bit vigilant because its bite was not very nice. Sometimes one would stop And the body would just, and for myself and others, would just stop and one would be absolutely convinced that there was a snake right at one's feet. And every sensation that took place in the body and every perception seemed to absolutely confirm it. So the effect of it was, of course, there'd be sensations, there'd be heat running through the body, a lot more I can tell you than without the air conditioning, and everything, all the messages, and the thoughts would arise. How long do I have to stand here with this? If I move, what will happen? And all that was going on, and then one indicated one had grasped a whole situation. And with the grasping came the desire. How am I going to get out of this? Because if I move my foot, I'll get bitten. So a whole world got born out of the perception, out of the feeling, out of the imagination, and out of the complete conviction that a few centimetres from one's big toe, there was a snake there and it couldn't wait to bite. And then one looked again, as we have been doing over the days, and looked again, it wasn't a snake. There was no snake there to grasp. And everything in the body then undergoes a complete change. In a way, Dharma teachings are a pointer to that. A pointer that, in a way, takes the power out of the problem of life. And non-grasping is one of the great teachings for that.